All right. So today is an unusual day. Maybe they're all unusual, but this is unusual, obviously, because of the attacks on Friday in France. So we had one plan for today's show, and we've sort of provisionally scrapped it. What we're going to do is talk about life after the Paris attacks with a couple of different guests. But we also are trying to leave a lot of room for you to call in and talk about the things that concern you, whether those things are our military strategy in the Middle East or how life is going to be in airports, how many more of your communications can and should be monitored for in order to anticipate the kind of activity that we saw on Friday. How do you feel about the demagoguing, if that's the right word, or the refugee issue, and the way in which the Paris attacks have now spilled into the American presidential debate? All of that is on the table today as we go along here. I wouldn't call in yet because we're going to start out with something different. But as we go along here, you should know the number. Make note of the number, 860-275-7266. We will be taking a lot of phone calls, or so I hope today, about all of these issues. 860-275-7266. A little later in the show, one of the ways these things inevitably play out is in a confusion by some Americans who confuse the average devout or non-devout Muslim with the kind of person who does the things that were done on Friday. This happened in a very unfortunate and distasteful way at UConn over the weekend. We'll talk to a UConn student who's been very close to that situation and who also wants the campus to have a different kind of conversation about these issues. But first, we are going to kind of get down to brass tacks here with some of the response that has happened and may happen to these attacks. And to do that, a regular guest here on WNPR is Scott Bates. He is the president of the Center for National Policy. He joins us now. There's so many places to go, Scott Bates, but obviously the president spoke earlier today. And overall, you may have heard other things in what he said, but overall, his message was something like what we need to be doing is what we have been doing, that as far as he's concerned anyway, the way to meet ISIS, at least over there, is the way that it's being met right now. Did you hear him setting the table for other kinds of responses or for thinking about this issue in a different way?
I think his thinking on the issue is relatively unchanged, even though the Paris attacks, the scope and the scale of it, to me, were as shocking as anything since 9/11, because we're talking about a global city that was attacked simultaneously and in a manner that it wasn't about symbolic targets. It was just to wreak absolute havoc and kill as many people as possible. However, what was lost in the news cycle was that very day, U.S. air power was being used in northern Iraq against Islamic State terrorist army in coordination with Kurdish forces, and it led to real setbacks for them. We took ground away from ISIS, and I think that you can see more of that coming, and I think you can see, but it'll be very limited, targeted use of force. The president, in his comments, as I read them today, he said, look, it's kind of steady as she goes. This is horrific, but we have a plan and we're working it. I think he's going to have to up the tempo of that, and I think that he's going to have to respond to our allies' legitimate concerns. And now he's got a domestic political problem, obviously, with taking in refugees here in the United States. But on the whole, I'd agree that with the president that, if you use a hammer on this problem, it only makes it worse, and this is a long-term challenge that we're going to have to face. But I would differ with him and say that we do have to up the tempo, and I think that's going to happen with the next president. You can see it with Hillary's language on this, and certainly with the Republicans as well.
Right. It is clear that if the next president is not named Bernie, the next president is going to have a very different policy from President Obama. And Hillary Clinton has positioned herself all along as somebody who 3 years ago was already saying, no, we need to be more aggressive. We need to do more. And she's obviously walking that wire between, in a way that seems almost traitorous, distancing herself from the administration in which she served and making it clear that she really did have a different set of policies, that she didn't go along with everything that was suggested by President Obama. I guess one thing that I would ask you is, one thing that I thought was sort of clear from President Obama's remarks today is obviously, he's the driver of of the U.S. foreign policy. But this is an international stage. There are a lot of other stakeholders in all this. And even what he said today about the U.S. coordinating with France on the airstrikes, I mean, I think it's pretty clear that this is not something that the United States even has the choice of going alone. It's going to have to happen in partnership with NATO allies, and it's going to have to happen with some awareness of what Russia and Putin want to do about this. Can you shed a little bit more light on how that's likely to play out?
Yeah, no, I think the next thing we can look for is NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, invoking Article 5 of their treaty, or France will ask for this, and that is the right of self-defense. If one is attacked, then all support. And the last time this was done was the attacks of September 11th. What that will allow for is very tight military coordination, the likes of which we haven't seen yet, between NATO, which is 28 countries, basically in Western Europe, the U.S. and Canada. And then we can coordinate with Russia as well. There is a NATO-Russia coordinating capacity that exists. And I think that would make a lot of sense if you're talking about focusing on Islamic State targets. Russia hasn't exactly been doing that. I think now the European Union, if it really wants to kind of get its act together on this one and really inflict the most damage possible on IS, what they need to do is put pressure on a couple places, on Russia, to direct energy against Islamic State, not against just random rebels, and also on Saudi Arabia and Turkey, because these are two Sunni Muslim states that, you know, they did token efforts against IS after the Jordanian pilot was burned alive, you may remember, a while ago. And then they've turned their attention to fighting Shia rebels. So, you know, there's a lot of players on the ground, but suffice it to say, this could be the moment where, if the Europeans get it together, they could focus everybody's energy just particularly on the Islamic State. And we need to have, as you pointed out, not just the Europeans, but us and Sunni Muslim states in the fight as well. And that's possible to happen.
You know, as I listen to you talk, Scott Bates, I feel as though you feel that there is something approaching a right answer or better answer than we've had. I mean, one response that one gets a lot is what Tony Blair, possibly defending his own Iraq policy, said, which was, you know, that intervention and non-intervention, no matter what you do, it doesn't really work out. ISIS came to prominence from the base in Syria, not in Iraq. We tried intervention and putting down troops in Iraq, and we tried intervention without putting troops in Libya. And we've tried no intervention at all, but demanding regime change in Syria. It's not clear to me that even if our policy in Iraq didn't work, subsequent policies have worked better. So, and you hear that a lot, right? It's that it's not as though President Obama or anybody else isn't reaching for the obvious right answer. The first question is there a right answer?
No, there's no one answer. Let's put it that way. And so the world, first of all, the world's too small. And I think the president and some of the people around him have hoped that this would not reach out beyond Syria, frankly, and that it would be somehow contained. And that's just, the world is way too small for that. We've seen it this summer with the refugees into Europe. Now we've seen ISIS, which before we said didn't have the capacity to do these kind of actions, clearly does, and at some point could probably reach out and hit here too. So, no, it's not a singular answer. However, I think the main principle when fighting terrorism is you cannot allow terrorists to have sanctuary in one place for a long time. And the fact is that for a year and a half now, and we don't want to call it Islamic State, but it has all the attributes of one. It's functioning on territory, controlling resources, and it has an army. And it's been in place for a year and a half. And we can't allow that. End of the day. Now, does that mean that we have to take ownership of the whole region? Does it mean we have to set it all right and turn it into a, you know, a kind of ideal place to live? Absolutely not. But if you're talking about our fundamental security and helping allies in the region, it means not allowing the likes of IS to set up shop in the second biggest city of Iraq and the third biggest in Syria, and they own those, and they have for a year and a half. So that part, we have to take ground back with allies on the ground, and that's going to be an ugly solution to an even uglier problem.
You know, one other thing that you could say is a strong probability come the change of administrations here in the U.S. There's a stronger probability, particularly if these tensions remain in place, that we'll be talking more seriously about a no-fly zone. I mean, we know this because it's been part of Hillary Clinton's discussions all along, that she'd like to see something resembling a no-fly zone. She thinks it's achievable. And we know that many of the Republican candidates who know far less than Hillary Clinton knows about foreign policy and about how these things are done are nonetheless also talking about no-fly zones. Obviously, this is an alarming prospect when you think about Russian involvement in all this. Either they're going to subscribe to the no-fly zone, or we're going to be put into a position of having sharp disagreements about who flies where. Maybe you can react to that.
Sure. A no-fly zone is useful, I think, for our purposes in carving out areas of northern Syria where we would be able to host the displaced persons. Now we're talking close to 7 million at the end of the day. There's a couple million outside of Syria. I'll be in Jordan in about 10 days. There are about 800,000 Syrians there. So that's number one, to alleviate the humanitarian crisis and show to the Muslim world that we actually do care about the situation. We're not turning our backs, and we're going to use Western unique military assets to keep their people safe in northern Syria, on the ground that need protection. And I think those would be under UN authority. They could be from a lot of Muslim countries. But these are places where you'd want to have the refugees, and they would be protected from ISIS and from the Assad regime as well. I see no reason why we can't do that. That's something that whose time has come, if you're talking about taking care of the refugee situation and demonstrating to the Muslim world that we actually do care about this open wound in the heart of the Muslim world. And, you know, if you're talking about the Russians, I think that they would be persuaded once you have the U.S. and the Europeans saying, look, this is what we need to do. So they would be the least of my worries at this point. So that's achievable. What we must not do is the kind of reckless fear-mongering or succumb to fear-mongering that's going on out there right now, especially out of Ted Cruz and other people. And, you know, would like to say that they're wing nuts, and this isn't in the, but already I think four or five governors around the country have said, you know, we're not taking in any refugees, and you know, it's amazing to me that we're going to turn on our back on some fundamental values when something like this arises. You know, at this very time, it's important to demonstrate that we're going to support the hundreds of thousands of people out there who are being driven away by ISIS out of their home and having their relatives killed. And that means putting in safe zones for them, that we'll use our unique power and assets to do that, and we'll work with allies for a longer-term solution.
Right. I mean, also, just from the point of view of enlightened self-interest, you want to have a humane, inclusive refugee policy, because today's estranged refugee is potentially tomorrow's enemy as well.
I couldn't agree more. And the narrative that ISIS peddles is, you know, first of all, that they are unstoppable. So that's why I say we have to take some ground and inflict some real losses on them, because that really hasn't happened to date. It's starting to briefly, but that's number one. The second part of their narrative is that, you know, the world doesn't care about them, and because they're Muslim and hates them, and therefore they have to unite together and fight everybody who hates them. Well, you know, we need to prove that a lie, and it's hard, because this kind of carnage that we saw is frightening and does invoke in all of us, you know, a kind of anger, a righteous anger, that you want to make sure this never happens again. And the fact is that it will happen with increasing fury if we don't handle it well. And that takes a lot of self-discipline on our part and a lot of courage. I mean, it is not courageous to tell helpless people they can't seek refuge on our shores. That is not, you know, a courageous, patriotic act at all. So we really, you know, have to punish political leaders who are peddling that kind of narrative. I think it's understandable the American people writ large are concerned and nervous and worried. But, you know, end of the day, we've gotten through these kind of things before. We will again. But I do think the reason, one thing that makes this different than, say, 9/11 and those times, is that the Islamic State has set up shop for far too long, and that just can't be something that's allowed to continue.
We're talking to Scott Bates, president of the Center for National Policy. I think we've got Martin from Mansfield on the line with a question. In a little while, I won't have anybody as smart or as knowledgeable as Scott to assist me, but I will be taking your phone calls all the way through the show at 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. For now, though, you've got Scott, and here's Martin from Mansfield. What's on your mind?
Thank you, Colin, for taking my call, and thank you, Mr. Bates, for being part of this. I have two comments I'd like to make. First, on the issue of Article 5 of the NATO Charter, and this is something that really needs to be looked at with very clear and sober minds. It could invoke the law of unintended consequences in a very bad way to put Turkey, especially, and some other nations in that alliance with sizable Muslim populations to force their hands into something that could cause a lot of distress within their own populations. It's something that maybe cooler heads might prevail to say, is there another way to do it? Certainly behind the scenes, there could be a lot of diplomacy where the major powers, the strongest of the military powers, certainly can and already are getting together in order to combat this, and it is the right thing to combat ISIS. They certainly have demonstrated that to the world. But also, in reference to the point you just made about acting with courage, and that is something that it is great that this show comes with juxtaposition of the previous show, in which the differences between French society and integration of immigrants was contrasted with American society. We all at this point need to show courage and extend our hands out to Muslims.
All right. Well,
we need to show that we really are not, as a society, that we are not at war with Islam. We are at war with ISIS.
It's a great point, Martin, and I want to have Scott respond to your first point, that not everybody is going to, not everybody in the NATO coalition will look at an Article 5 invocation exactly the same way. What do you say to that?
Sure. So the good news about that, Article 5 of the NATO charter, is that it is by consensus. So every nation state would effectively get to ask themselves, is this something that we believe in and that the traffic can bear? It also doesn't say what you must do. It says that there'll be collective action to support a member who has been attacked. So that can range from anything to, you know, intelligence sharing to, you know, coordination of military assets. Currently, there are several NATO countries. We're talking about the U.S., Canada, the U.K., France, I believe the Netherlands, even Norway have done some airstrikes against ISIS. So that would just open the door to countries like Germany and Italy to contribute as well. Germany has not done anything on that front. And I think it would be a very good forum for intensified intelligence collection as well. And if I could digress a bit for a second, because you touched on this about surveillance, France has some of the most sweeping surveillance laws in Europe. It allows for extensive collection. So I don't think that kind of toughening up or tightening or expanding, I should say, electronic surveillance would do much to aid the current situation.
No, it does seem to that point that we're in kind of it's more like an arms race of computing power, right? I mean, there's been some journalism recently about the fact that some people blame the Snowden leak, some people don't, some people just blame, you know, the fact that the things we buy these days have WhatsApp, which is like maybe a little bit more nimble communication program or encryption on an iPhone, that there's sort of things out there that may allow terrorists to run a little bit ahead of surveillance until surveillance catches up.
Yeah, that's going to be a constant cat and mouse battle. Usually we have an edge on that kind of thing in terms of the technological prowess of the nation state over the individual. But, you know, really what we need more of is human intelligence. That's what ultimately wraps up these cells, is having people around these people that will turn on them, having our own people in place. And that takes a long time. It takes a lot of patience, and it takes excellent relationships with some of the communities that some people would demonize right now. And we can't have that. That would be a serious blow
to our struggle against violent extremists. We need to have open, trusting relationships with the very communities that from which some of these people might arise.
Well, to that end, if you debrief 65,000 refugees, you're probably going to get some human intelligence. I mean, people may know things.
This is exactly right, and it's already clear, some of the reading I've been doing today, that, there have already been some leads that came from people who had been in Syria, and for whatever reason or whatever method, the French had figured that out. They had eyes and ears on the ground there, and we need more. And that takes, that's two-track, right? You have to kind of try to get people recruited immediately, but in the longer term, it takes real study and understanding of other cultures and lands, which we're not so good about all the time. And if we won't do it for the sake of education, we needed to do it for the sake of our security.
So, Scott Bates, as we begin to wind down here, let me ask you a question. I'm going to sort of use a tweet from Nick from Norwich, but I'll sort of summarize it a different way. But I think it's kind of what he's getting at. So one of the arguments here is, well, ISIS really wants to be in a pitched and protracted battle with the West, right? That's one of their goals. It legitimizes them. It elevates them to the status of state or movement or civilization, whatever it is that they want to be called. And that in some ways, if they behead two Americans or kill 129 people in Paris, and we strike back with airstrikes that knock out power and transportation in Syria and cause casualties among people who are not members of ISIS, that ultimately we're playing their game. We're getting deeper and deeper into a battle against an enemy which can only benefit from that battle. How do you react to that argument?
Right. Well, I think that's exactly why we need to have more than just an American answer to what's a global problem. I think we have to have Muslim allies front and center, as we did 6-8 months ago after the Jordanian pilot was killed. We had 4 or 5 Arab air forces in the initial wave of strikes. Well, we need to intensify that cooperation. We need them out in front. So, yeah, this cannot be seen playing into the crusader narrative that ISIS has, that it's the West against the Muslim world. Absolutely not. On the other hand, they do exist as a functioning state or statelet, whatever you want to call it, right now. And so I think what our friend in Norwich is referencing was basically more appropriate to 10 years ago when it was just Al-Qaeda that was seeking to draw us in. Well, we got in, and it's not just American involvement that's led to this. It's a rift in the Muslim world itself. It's metastasized, and now it's going to take a very highly coordinated effort, a patient effort, and one underpinned by, you know, adult conversations between American leaders and the populace and the courage of the American people to understand and put this in context, put this threat in context. This is not going to destroy the United States or our allies. It will cost some lives. It will cost treasure. But we can't lose our values in the process, and we can't lose our cool because the world's too small and our capabilities are too large and can inflict tremendous damage if we're not careful.
All right. Well, that's a lot of needles we've got to thread, but I guess we're going to have to try to thread them all. Scott Bates, president of the Center for National Policy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks.
And when we come back, I really am opening up the phones and the tweet lines, I don't know, what do you open with a tweet? But anyway, 860-275-7266. I'll pose a few questions when we come back, but you may have things you specifically want to talk about, and I want to make the airwaves available to you. 860-275-7266. All right, we're back. This is Colin McEnroe. So one thing I decided to do today, rather than book a lot more guests, which we could have done, is to make room for you. One of the questions that I have is, for you, how much of this is a game changer? Will Saladin, writing for Slate, said, if you're one of the millions of young people who enjoyed this period of relative comfort. He's talking about the 14 years in between the events of 9/11 and now. He says, I'm sorry to tell you that it's coming to an end. If Madrid, London, or Mumbai didn't wake you up, Paris should. In the last week, 3 major terrorist attacks, not just in France, but in Lebanon and against a Russian airliner in Egypt, have killed more than 400 people. ISIS has claimed responsibility for all 3 massacres. A year ago, you could have said that the terrorists who wanted to hit the West couldn't pull it off, or that those who couldn't pull it off didn't have the ambition. You can't say that anymore. And Saladin goes on in a really interesting article to just talk about the ways in which this will affect life in the West. He does see this as a breaking point between then and now. I'd love to hear from you about that. Do you feel as though things become different as a result of Paris? Our number 860-275-7266. And if you think things are going to become different, how? 860-275-7266. Other things I'd like to get into as we go along here. Obviously, this then has tipped into the political debate here in this country. It sort of changed the terms of Saturday night's Democratic debate. And as Scott Bates and I were talking about, candidates are now sort of lining out their positions a little bit more forcefully about this, making it clear where they are on it, how they may differ from others. And then also in there somewhere, and this may be something that I would expect NPR listeners to have some passionate thoughts about, what one might call the demagoguing of the refugee crisis, also something that Scott and I touched on. But it started with the Republican governors of Alabama and Michigan announcing that their states would not accept Syrian refugees. 2 more Republican governors this morning, Asa Hutchinson of Arkansas and Greg Abbott of Texas, jumped in there with the same kind of announcement. And since then, I believe 3 more governors, Bobby Jindal in Louisiana, Indiana Governor Mike Pence, and even Charlie Baker, the governor of Massachusetts, have also followed suit with an announcement, no Syrian refugees. So we'd love to hear what you think about that. You may have your own things that you want to talk about, and I'll try to be a good conversationalist with you. I may not know exactly the thing that you're asking about, but we can help each other out that way. A little bit later, too, I do want to let you hear a conversation that I had earlier this morning with Ahmad Uda. He's a junior at UConn. UConn, like a lot of other places, had that quick backlash, that knee jerk, and I would probably emphasize the word jerk in that somebody wrote late at night something on the door of a Muslim student at UConn. Ahmad Uda has some pretty strong thoughts about what UConn and other college communities like UConn need to do about situations like that. But before I get to that, I'd rather get some of you involved here. 860-275-7266. And you can tweet us at WNPR Colin. Why don't we start with Jim in Newtown? Hi, Jim.
Hi. How are you, Colin? I just wanted to speak to the importance of all media adopting the true name for this organization of terrorists, and that is Daesh, or Daesh, as the French president has used the term, the president of Holland, and as our own president used the term to describe what has been called ISIS or ISIL in the past. Daesh is the name of the organization, and they hate it when they use their name, that name. The origin of this name is a fascinating linguistic topic that Arabic translator Alice Guthrie has written about extensively online, and it's so important that we use that term because it delegitimizes their message.
I think it's a really important point that you're making. First of all, I read so much today about not only what to call this movement, but also, I mean, one of the problems, obviously, if we're going to make that transition is that then you have to say, that's the thing it's almost like Prince, you know, that's the thing we used to refer to as ISIS or ISIL. Otherwise, people get confused. But within that is a larger conversation. And I'm just putting Jim on hold because his phone was kind of breaky. But within that is also a really interesting conversation about what this organization is. You know, it obviously aspires to statehood. There's no way in which it fits into the normal definition of what a state is. First of all, it's way too small. I mean, it's in numbers, they're difficult to quantify. But as you'll hear when I'm talking later, Amtab and Uta, by one count, by the CIA's manpower count, whatever this organization is, and whatever we're going to call it, it's got maybe 31,500 people who actually actively work for that, maybe other sympathizers as well, which, as somebody pointed out, is about 1/3 the capacity of the Rose Bowl. So it's probably not a state, and it probably shouldn't be treated that way. I'll put on hold the whole question of what we call it. And first of all, I have to learn to pronounce the new word. But I'd also be happy to hear from the rest of you on that. 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. Here's Jason in Plainville. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Colin. How you doing?
Good.
The John Stewart really, we need John Stewart at a time like this because he always helped us understand why we should care about things like letting the Syrian refugees in and extending our hand to the Muslims, and rather than making it a holy war against them. Whereas the 24-hour news cycle, those places inform, but they always fail to demonstrate why we should care. They only just present the information. You can argue whether or not they do it well. But as a student of the media in journalism as you are, I figured you could help more fully form my thesis there.
Well, it's a great point, Jason, although the one thing that I would say is that Jon Stewart himself only had a limited audience, right? His ability to transform opinion, it wasn't non-existent, but it wasn't unlimited. It could only go so far as, first of all, people who would watch his show usually late at night. But I think what he really was great at it was talking to a younger demographic about some of these issues. If you go and read Saladin's piece, he talks about the fact that when you look at polling, the younger demographic in America, because in fact they don't have a clear memory of the attacks of September 11th, think about this differently. They're less likely to want to respond aggressively to ISIS or ISIL or whatever we're going to call them. And they see it as a less pressing issue. Now, that may have all changed this past weekend. But one thing Stewart was really good at doing was talking to that group of people who haven't been educated about this by direct experience, and talking about ways to think about it and ways to react. Now, I would also say young people tend to be a lot better than older people on the kinds of issues that you're describing, Jason, extending sympathy to Syrian refugees and understanding that the Muslim world, even certain aspects of the radical Muslim world, is still not the same as ISIL or ISIS or Daesh or whatever we're going to call them. So
your previous guest, when he described it as we need the courage to reach out to these people, really just put it in words that I hadn't thought of before. That really is like, so when the fear mongering is happening, you know, we do need the courage. And that's where liberals shouldn't be demonized as being wimps. But really, it takes a lot of courage to reach out to who you fear and accept them into your world.
Listen, thanks a lot for your call, Jason. It wasn't a thing that I'd thought about very much, but it's an interesting thing to talk about, too. Who are the voices that you listen to in a situation like this? Who makes sense and who's merely politically posturing? And, of course, there is, as Jason suggests, there's this entire industry of cable news networks that basically are in the business of packaging up argumentation and selling it to you along with commercials. Here's Dave in Waterbury. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I agree. We need to reach out and lend aid. However, we also need to take off the gloves. If we're going to get in a fight, take off the gloves and fight.
Well, no, to you, what does that mean?
Because we're coming off like moral cowards.
Hmm. To you, what does it mean to say take off the gloves? What is that?
Well,
what does that look like?
I'm an eight-year Marine Corps veteran. I served in Beirut, Lebanon during the bombing. And when you're told, I'm not sure if you know the term, justified fire.
Mm-hmm.
You're told, you know, you can't shoot at the enemy until you're directly shot upon. Please, when you're staring down the barrel of an AK-47, you know who the enemy is.
Right. Although I think here, and thanks for your call, Dave, I hear traffic in the background, so I'm going to put you on hold just so you can, I don't want you driving and talking. Here, first of all, I think one of the things President Obama is reacting against, one of the reasons he may not have been as aggressive as people might want him to be, is, first of all, the lesson of the past. I mean, we know, I think it is a fair thing to say, Tony Blair notwithstanding, that the destabilization of Iraq created conditions in which this new group could flourish. And the second thing is, and this is an incredibly funky situation here. You have a pre-existing civil war to which you add the new element of ISIS, ISIL, or whatever we're going to call them. In order to say, we're going to put ground troops there in a situation where almost everybody else, there's three warring factions, all of whom know the terrain better, all of whom know how to function in that environment better. It's not a casual thing to do. It's not something that we should do without really understanding what we're getting into. It's also, as we said in the past, as we said with Scott Bates, it's, you know, in some ways it does play a little bit into the hands of ISIS, ISIL, because in fact, that's what they want. They want to be in a ground battle with us. It further legitimizes them and their activities. All right, we're going to take a very quick break. We'll be back after this. Peter from Mansfield, Derek from Hartford, stay on the line. The rest of you can call in too, 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. We'll be back after this.
Today's show is produced by Tucker Ives and me, Kyone Wolf. Our interns are Amanda Gallagher and Zachary LaSala. Greg Hill tweets for us at WNPR Colin, and for show pages, articles, and videos, visit our website, WNPR.org/Colin. Tomorrow, a show about historical fiction. Now, back to Colin.
All right, we are back. We're taking your phone calls as we go along here in our final segment. We'll also play the conversation I had with Ahmed Uda. He is the junior at UConn who is concerned about at least one, so far, we would hope, isolated expression of hostility towards a fellow Muslim student there and what he wants to see the campus do. But meanwhile, we're happy to talk to you, 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. Let's grab a call from Derek in Hartford. Hi, Derek. You're on the air.
Hi, Colin. This is not Hartford. It's Windsor.
Windsor. Oh, yeah, Windsor. Sorry about that.
All right. Well, I just have a comment. I don't know if it's a popular one, but that's the way how I feel.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is that part of our value here in this country is to be able to speak freely, free speech, as they say. But along with that comes responsibility. And I'm talking about the recent attack in France. And this Charlie Hebdo, if that's the name, if I pronounce it correctly, that they went out and print his magazine of depicting the Prophet Muhammad. I am saying they know that these things are offensive to these, you know, Muslim folks that are, you know, bringing on this kind of atrocity. So in my mind, it is responsible for them to go out and print this kind of magazine. Like I say again, bear in mind, we know we're talking about free speech, but at the same time, it comes with responsibility. And if you know that these things will provoke these folks, my question is, why is it that these folks go out and do these kind of things? And if you look who are suffering at the hands, it's the common people on the street. These folks do what they do, and they are guarded. I'm pretty sure all of those folks that lost their lives are just common folks, you know, being out on the street trying to have a good time, because most of the people in authority that talk this kind of way, they are pretty much guarded.
Although, actually, in
myself and others who are exposed.
Although in France, Derek. In France, it's worth noting that Hollande was actually there in the soccer stadium. So if you're saying that all of the sort of the people who have authority are protected, well, in some ways, it's been even been suggested that maybe the president of France wasn't protected enough. All right, let's grab a call here from Amy in New Haven. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Colin. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. Fire away.
Go, okay. By the way, I'm a clergy person, and I am a colleague of Nancy Butler, who you had on your show before.
Yes.
And I'm kind of speaking from that position because I mostly am what I would say a pacifist, you know, based on my religious beliefs and my spiritual life. But this morning I heard on NPR in the news when I was driving my daughter to school about a Frontline documentary that's going to be coming up about ISIS in Afghanistan and how they are teaching 3- and 4- and 5-year-olds how to use weapons, and they're teaching them about jihad. And my heart just sank because I thought, oh, here's another generation that we're going to have to deal with this kind of training and hatred. And then I started to just kind of flip a little, like, well, maybe we should come back very strong against them militarily, even though in general I'm not really into that. You know, like, I don't really support that. But I just don't know. So I really was actually interested in what you had to say about it.
Well, so let me, I'll get right at your level with this. I was actually at church on Sunday listening to Nancy Butler preach, and we got into a conversation afterwards about what I now refer to as table flipping versus olive branching. So if you look at what Jesus, if you look at Jesus's activities and message, you know, there's some table flipping, right? He goes to the temple. He doesn't like the way things are. He thinks they're evil and wrong. He flips tables over. But he also spends an awful lot of time olive branching. And I certainly think that one of my concerns sometimes about Christianity is certain Christian movements seem to get, they're like only interested in table flipping, and they totally forget about the olive branching part. Whereas I think
right.
we should be probably 90-10, you know, 90% yeah. olive branching, maybe 10% table flipping where it's called for. So, I mean, in listening to you, this is what I'll sort of say back that maybe I hear you saying, is that probably a lot of the efforts that we make that are humanitarian in nature will have a more lasting meaning. That, in fact, if we are open and giving and supportive, not only to refugees coming into this country, but supportive of refugees in these other countries, Turkey, Lebanon, Jordan, which have had to bear this incredible brunt, those activities and the profile that we have as a result of this, it will be as likely to defend us against further attacks. I mean, this is not the last organization of this kind we're going to have to deal with. They're going to come along
exactly.
more and more. They're going to want to recruit more new members. It's harder to recruit. It's hard even for them to recruit new members if, in fact, our fundamental message is olive branching, and if it is one of support for the beleaguered people of these regions. And letting them stay beleaguered and vulnerable and hungry and hurt and afraid doesn't do anybody any good. So, you know, I mean, I listen to Scott Bates, and I mean, I think he makes a good argument for a little bit of what you might call table flipping, that, you know, some of this has to be answered militarily. You do want to degrade some of their ability to hurt other people. But yeah, maybe the preponderance of what we do should be in that other category. How does that work for you?
That works. That works. I think what really got to me was the children. I was like, that is just
exactly
wrong.
All right. I'm being told I've got to go to the Ahmed Ouda tape, or we'll run out of time. So we're going to do that right now. One of the things we want to talk about today is how people process this kind of thing, and how here on the domestic front, people who are Muslim have to hear about it from people who drastically misunderstand this issue or just have kind of a knee-jerk reaction to it. One of the places that this happened was at UConn, where, in fact, a young student there had the words "killed Paris" written on his door. Right now, joining us is Ahmed Ouda. He's a junior at UConn. He is a friend of the person who had that written on the door. Ahmed Ouda, first of all, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Colin.
Just for starters, I kind of alluded to what happened, but in your own words, explain what did happen to your friend.
He woke up the day after the tragedy that happened in Paris to find "killed Paris" written underneath his name on his door tag. He was already devastated by what happened in Paris, and when he saw this, he just broke into tears.
I would imagine that he did. And so I know that there's been some call now to the administration of UConn to frame this somehow, to begin a deeper conversation about this. Tell us what's happened on campus so far.
We've been lucky to see that the initial reaction has been strong, especially by the student body. We hope that the administration is going to take our suggestions into light, but we're not really planning on letting them off the hook. I mean, this has been going around all around the country. We really want to make a change this time, and we think UConn can be the forefront of a lot of change all around the country.
So on this issue, on how Muslims are spoken to and perceived, to the degree to which they're kind of arbitrarily linked to an event like that, what kind of change would you look for? What would be an ideal outcome, and what would be the means to get there?
I think an ideal outcome would be open communication with the public. I grew up in post-9/11 United States. I'm Muslim. Every single time something terrible like this happens, I feel the need to explain myself when I really shouldn't. I mean, I don't even associate with these people. I abhor what they do and everything they stand for. But for some reason, I always feel the pressure. My heart drops a little bit. So what I'm hoping is that on a national level, we start listening to each other. I mean, we're all citizens of the world, and we owe it to ourselves and our communities to make it a safe place to be.
It is interesting the way we get into, there's a double bind here, right? On the one hand, and I really love this tweet from Mohammed Gilan, the thinker, last year tweeted, asking me to condemn the obviously condemnable presumes my basic moral code is in question. I refuse to take part in this. So whenever there's something like this, and certainly still in my mind from 9/11, there's a lot of hue and cry saying, well, the Muslims have to condemn this. They have to condemn this in the strongest and most overt terms, which most Muslims do and will do. But there's something offensive implicitly about demanding that, right? That you bear some special burden to condemn something which any reasonable person understands is evil and abhorrent. How do you react in that conversation?
I think he's spot on. My entire goal is just to make sure that people know that this is a very inhumane act. And I want to make sure that people recognize that Muslims are human too, and therefore they also think it's inhumane. I've never, ever met anybody who said that this is okay in my life, ever. Not when I visit Egypt, not in the United States, not when I go to a mosque. So I think it's absurd that people have this notion that we have to justify ourselves, that, like you said, there's this inherent assumption that our moral code is in question.
Some of this, I would think, I'm talking to Ahmed Ouda, a junior at UConn. So we know what the goal is. The goal is a more open flow of communication, maybe in a more open flow of information, too. I'm not sure how many people understand. I mean, by one CIA estimate, the total manpower of ISIS or ISIL is 31,500. So the entire world Muslim population is about 1.6 billion. So you get a sense of what an incredibly tiny slice of the Muslim population would be at least nominally or actively associated with ISIL. But maybe those are numbers that people don't know. Maybe those are, when you think about them that way, there's an absurdity that's obvious about linking the average Muslim, no matter where he or she is living, to ISIL. It doesn't really make any sense numerically. But, I mean, maybe that's the kind of thing that you're talking about, that somehow or other conversations about those kinds of things have to happen, I don't know, in some kind of fairly organized way. Like, at UConn, what would you like to see happen? Would you like to see forums, campus-wide conversations? I mean, how does that take place on a college campus?
What we're pushing for right now is to have more diversity and tolerance trainings. Just like there's sex ed trainings, just there's campus and alcohol safety training during orientations. We've spoken to the dean of students about maybe introducing a diversity supplemental essay into the application, things that ensure that people who are joining the UConn community are accepting. And this isn't to shelter them. This is because culture starts at university campuses. University campuses produce educated people that will hopefully in the future shape how we live. If we shape their lives now and make sure that they're tolerant, open-minded, accepting people, then maybe 20 years down the line, this won't be a problem anymore.
I wonder also, and I guess there may be no way to answer this question, but I sometimes think, you know, you can have these forums, and I think they're great. I think it can work, and it can make a difference. On the other hand, there are going to be some people who kind of sleepwalk through that whole process and come 2 a.m. on, you know, Saturday night, there's still going to be that jerk who writes that thing on your friend's door. I wonder if there's a way to have a more profound kind of conversation that really does change people. I fear anyway that people walk through the processes that you're describing right now, but they don't really engage with it.
Yep, and what I'm hoping is I'm hoping to put the pressure on them to not do this, to think about this. Next time this person goes to do something like this, they're going to think about the last time this whole uproar happened, and they'll think twice. So even if they don't change their mentality right away, at the very least, they won't take action. And maybe somewhere down the line, they will learn that what they did was very hurtful, very wrong, and that they damaged somebody's psyche, they damaged the way somebody thinks about the world just because of a stupid action, even if you're drunk on Saturday night at 2 a.m.
Ahmed Uda, first of all, good luck with all this, and it'll be interesting to watch how this unfolds at UConn and what UConn and other colleges do specifically with this situation. I mean, it's a very fraught, intense situation, and you're to be applauded for standing up for it. And thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Colin.
He was great. And so thanks to everybody who helped out today. And the conversation can go on longer. I would welcome emails to me at Colin, C-O-L-I-N, at WNPR.org. You might even want to give us a show suggestion. We're actually debating right now what Thursday's show is going to be. So give us some ideas, WNPR.org. We won't necessarily do it about post-Paris actions, but we could conceivably do that. So send me an email.